Welcome to Influential Visions. Here we interview futuristic leaders who share their deep industry knowledge and business experience with you, ensuring you have your finger on the pulse and your eyes wide open. Here is your host, Nathaniel Schooler.
Here's another interview from the archives with Nicholas Babin, who is an expert in gamification and in business. He was a director of Sony Europe in AI and robotics. And you will find this very, very interesting conversation if you want to learn more about AI and gamification and how those work to motivate and encourage behaviors.
What actually is gamification?
Right. So there's an official, I would say, definition that came from Gabe Zickerman, a guy who started to work on gamification early 2000, I would say. And he says the gamification is the process of using game thinking and game mechanics to engage users and solve problems. So that's the official definition. To me, we could say also it's the integration of the mechanics that make game fun and absorbing into non-game platforms and experience in order to improve engagement and participation, because engagement is the key about gamification. Gamification is engagement, and how can we improve engagement for people?
Yeah, it's an interesting topic. I mean, I used to run a lot of leaderboards, which were quite a lot of fun, but it's very interesting because some people are completely demotivated by gamification. Others are absolutely motivated. Some people are just sort of in between, aren't they? But it's very difficult to actually engage the people that are just see everyone else miles ahead of them. And they get kind of stuck and they're like, oh, look at him. I'm never going to catch him or her, you know. And I think I've seen that because I used to run some leaderboards when I used to do events using Twitter hashtag. I used to create a leaderboard. And I would, you know, and I would promote it and I would use the tweet out function and promote all these people and have it on my website to drive web clicks. And, you know, because using it in that way, it delivers a tangible return in terms of like the clicks through to your website, targeted traffic and this sort of stuff. But, but you know, I'm sure we can kind of get into that in a minute. But so why did you start using gamification in the first place?
So gamification came to me a little bit naturally, if I could say. I used to work for Sony for about 15 years. So PlayStation, I was in charge of marketing, communication. And I kept thinking, like, you know, you go into a shop, any type of shop that sells television, for example, and you have Samsung brand, you have LG brand, you have Sony brand, you have all the different type of brands. And you're looking at all these televisions and I kept thinking, how could people decide to go for the Sony brand, obviously being Sony being my employer at the time. And so it was just as we were also at the same time launching PlayStation games and realizing, you know, like when we were trying the games, you could spend 2 hours and then at the end thinking, oh, it's already been 2 hours. How is that possible? You know, I didn't see time fly. And I was thinking there's a link between the fact that you spend 2 hours and just enjoy yourself and feel in a world that is just like, you know, perfect. And you're just capable of listening to messages that come from the games or playing with people abroad on the other side of the world. And so I thought, how can we put the two together? So at the time it was not called gamification. We're talking about 2004. So it was really, nobody knew about the gamification. And so my thinking was to say, well, maybe I should either engage, because the only link from the person's wallet to the television was the fact that the person will be engaged by the salesperson in the shop. So I was thinking, how can I engage the salespeople in a way that's fun to them? And so they could just do the same thing with their customers. And that's how we started the first gamification campaigns, I would say, quote unquote, by engaging more. And not only talking about, you know, money or which would be extrinsic motivation, but more about intrinsic motivation, which is the autonomy, the belonging, the mastery, the power, the fun, the love, all these very strong emotions that makes gamification work. If you're talking more about badges, because a lot of people tell me over the years, oh yeah, gamification is only about badges, and you have badge fatigues and all this, which is absolutely true, because you get bored with extrinsic motivation. So it was really trying to engage more and to make people more like the brand. So, you know, when somebody would face a Sony TV would think, oh, wow, I really enjoyed the brand Sony. The latest commercials that Sony have put out, they were really good. They really talked to me. And so that's the reason why you would go for a Sony TV. And that's how I started to work on it. And as I love gaming and I love marketing, that's basically how I got involved with gamification.
Right. So the actual purpose of gamification is to engage with whomever. It could be internally within the business, right? Or it could be externally to drive a desired action. Is that a fair comment, do you think?
What's the purpose of gamification? Again, gamification is all about engagement and to ensure that any type of activity is linked with engagement, obviously, and you want people to be engaged. I have examples of gamification campaigns that work on situations that you would not believe. For example, cancer treatment. My family has been hit with cancer. And so I did a lot of research to see how cancer patients could be more engaged and understand better how their treatment works. And I found this game that you play with a nanobot. You would go around, you know, shooting cancer cells with chemo weapons. So kids would go around doing that.
So you were saying about your family having some issues, unfortunately, with cancer, and how you come up with a great idea to gamify the cure, right? Well, the solution.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, it was not my idea, but I found the idea on the web about learning how to cope with the disease and learning how to cope with chemo going around for the disease. So the game I found was a game that was really for teenagers. They had a nanobot called Rory, and Rory would go around the room and would shoot at cancer cells using chemo weapons. That game helped, well, first to make sure that cancer was not anymore taboo. I mean, you know, obviously we had that problem, so we had to deal with it. But for children, it was really to explain how chemo worked and what the impact on their body was. And again, because it was a game, so then it was more, basically what I'm trying to say is that it was not as difficult to deal with as if it had been, any type of books that you have to read about chemo and about cancer. But I thought the fact that you can, you know, use gamification for this type of purpose means that you can use it for pretty much everything, because then gamification helps you engage, learn, understand, and cope with situations that are difficult, but because they are put as a game, relate also to fun. And that game apparently had a lot of success. And I'm wondering why I haven't seen much more of it, because it was back in 2010 that I've read about it and I've seen the game on the web. But these are things that you could find in pediatric wards, for example, and that could help children that have to stay in hospitals, that, you know, then they could just minimize the impact of their disease.
Wow. That's really quite smart, actually, because aren't children more susceptible to gamification, do you think, then? Are the children sort of more into it?
I would say yes, they are. They are definitely more involved with gamification because they play a lot. But I would say that the whole population is involved with gamification. Everybody plays. I mean, game comes from way before or at the time of the dinosaurs. So it comes before culture, because when you had a mother dinosaur, she would teach her cubs to play, and so at least they will learn how to hunt. We have examples also of it's not a game, it's not fun, but when Taylor in 1890 introduced the bonuses and awards in the Reform Factory. That's kind of also type of gamification.
Right.
I'm sorry. Okay. So it's you know, these type of rewards and bonuses has been used for quite a long time. I mean, you always had the carrot. Mary Poppins, I mean, if I can go and have many, many examples, because that's one of my passions. So, but Mary Poppins with the sugar principle, you know, the sugar makes the medicine go down. That's type of gamification as well, because medicine is not good. It's not fun. But if you make it fun next to it with a spoonful of sugar, then that's it. That Gabe Zuckerman mentioned that at a conference that I went to in New York a while back. And it's true. When you think about it, you know, we've all always had that around us. So children are definitely more inclined to react better to gamification, but adults are as well. Even older people who say, oh, I never play. Well, this is not true. You know, if they do crosswords, that's a play. That's a game, sorry. So anybody would play, and anybody would be sensitive to game mechanics. It's just what's very important when you do a gamification campaign is to find the right mechanics for the right people at the right time. And that's crucial, but that's pretty much marketing.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. So you've pretty much answered how you can use it. I mean, it motivates people to do something, right? Like that's pretty much what it is, yeah. Isn't it? Yeah.
Yep. And yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So in the beginning, you decide on what sort of behavior you want to encourage, and then you find the right game to encourage that behavior, right? And that could be like social sharing within IBM, for example, or, you know, encouraging the staff So I'll start again. So that could be, for example, working within a corporation and actually getting those people to share particular content. Just to wrap up, right, on that particular point, it's really just designing the outcome you want, mm-hmm. deciding on the outcome you want, designing yep. the game to encourage behavior towards that outcome. So it's very, very simple. It's just marketing, right? But gamifying behavior. So it could be social sharing within a corporation, encouraging internal stakeholders to share content externally. It could be external influencers and encouraging them to share content externally, or anything really, right? So which area is best for gamification?
I would answer all of them, seriously, because when with my customers, I use gamification for HR, how to motivate and get employees more productive. Oh. I use gamification for sales, and that's one of the points as well. Salesforce.com, the big CRM tool, has now a module with gamification inside, because what's the biggest challenge for CRM tools is to ensure that all data is entered regularly and professionally. Well, gamification is that. You know, you motivate salespeople to win with a leaderboard, for example, and you guys in the UK have great leaderboard companies, especially one, as you know it. So you just motivate them by creating healthy competition. And that's gamification, because it's fun. It's like, well, yeah, I'm, you know, 5 points behind you, but I'm going to get you, you know, this type of attitude that you want to get. So then marketing can also use gamification, because that's how they're going to get the motivation from their customers, prospects, or the link between the brand and the user of the brand. You're going to use it in finance to make sure, again, that, you know, finance reports are boring. I mean, I'm sorry to say, but it's very difficult to read them. Here with gamification, you can make them a little bit more attractive. You can make people understand them better. So pretty much every, I mean, you're talking about in a factory, so for people to get motivated to be more productive. They can also, you can also use, for example, big boards in the factory where you see where you are at. You've created 20 phones, your neighbor has done 25, you know, these type of things. So there's so many ways of motivating people in a fun way, and not, and so it's not only about money and not only in the factory, but in an overall company. Yeah, so even in factories, people can be more motivated using gamification, and you know, being on a in a way that they will either build faster products, or they will be more engaged. They will have a better time doing so, and so it's overall company. Basically, it's not only about money or giving more money for people to get more engaged, because this doesn't work. At the end, you'll get tired and it doesn't work. Whereas if you really work on the values of a company or of the employees that you have, then gamification can be really efficient. And that's why we're always trying to do when we do a gamification campaign.
Right. Right. So what results can you see with gamification?
So the results that I have seen is basically if normally for a marketing campaign, you see a return investment of about 10-12%, which is extremely good. But, you know, you have to spend a lot of money for that. In a gamification campaign, I usually see around 20-25% of return on the campaign. Because you're going to work with the four principles, which are status, access, power, and price, which is the where it's the most sticky is basically the status. You give a status to somebody, and the status doesn't cost much to the company. And at the end, you have the price, which the price could be a TV, could be a car, whatever. This is very expensive. We'll probably not remember 6 months down the line what kind of campaign the person has done. So if you use this SAPP practice, which also I believe came from Gabe Zuckerman, but is very good, because in marketing, it's something that you can really follow. And then your return investment is extremely high, because it doesn't cost much to say to somebody, your gold, your silver, your bronze, SAPP policies, if I could say, with S, with status, A, which is access, P, which is the power, and the second P is the price. So the status is what I mentioned with the gold, silver, or bronze status that you can find in any British Airways, for example, plan. You know, any type of loyalty type of program, then that's the status. The status, the beauty of the status is the fact that it doesn't cost anything for you to make somebody become a platinum or gold member. It's very sticky, because the person is proud of having that status. And they will remember the campaign that make them become bronze or whatever they have become. The access is, yeah, again, what you can see at the airports when you have access to a lounge, when you have access to any VIP treatment. For example, when you check in, you have the red carpet treatment when you are gold or platinum. Again, you know, it costs a little bit more money, because this time they have to have access to something special. If it's a lounge, they have access to drinks and food. If it's the red carpet, then obviously, you know, you have to have a dedicated staff for it, but it's not as expensive as, for example, the last one, which we'll see in a minute. The third one is the power. You give more power to people. You become gold, and for example, you'll be invited to a premiere of our products. You'll be able to get special prices before anybody else. You know, this type of power that you can give to your customers or prospects. And the last one is price, which I mentioned, is when you get to people say, "You use our system, come to our website or whatever, do this survey, and we will give you a TV, or we'll give you a car, or we'll give a car to the first person who does it, whatever you want to put as a mechanic." So by using these four SAPP, basically it doesn't cost much, especially if you focus on status and access, you can have a little bit of cost when you announce it and you talk about the you communicate around it, but it's where you can see really the best type of results and returns on investment, because again it's very powerful, it's efficient, and it doesn't cost much.
Right. So you can use this in any department, in any business, in well, marketing or any other department, right?
Absolutely. Any department in any company. Absolutely.
Yeah. 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 That's really interesting. Really interesting. So could gamification be misused, do you think, Nicholas?
Yes, I do believe gamification, there's a risk, of course, a risk of people cheating, but to me, the risks are, the first one is rewards not equivalent to achievements, meaning you have to work really hard to get a peanut, just as a joke. But, you know, you basically need to feel that whatever you do, you're going to get the right type of achievement. And so that's important. Then number two, when you do a gamification campaign, you need to be careful that you're not you don't have a limited participation bandwidth,
right?
Meaning you don't have enough people playing. So like, for example, if you try to get a survey out and you only get 10 people to participate, then it's not relevant for what you're trying to do. I mentioned about cheating. So that's what we mean by unintended consequences, gaming the system. And I've seen it, especially, and sometimes you've seen it in very small campaigns,
yeah,
and people try to win, and we were very surprised because the price or what people could get was not okay. That big, and so I was really surprised. But people can cheat anywhere, so you need to be very careful about that. And as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, is making sure that you don't undermine intrinsic values and interfere with social norms, meaning you have social norms, and you need to be very careful that the campaign follows the norms, because it's really important, or else pretty much. So yes, gamification needs, not everyone can just say, I'm going to do a gamification campaign. You need really to have a good marketing executive who's going to think about all this, but not only a marketing executive, also somebody who has gaming experience, and who has, user experience using this type of mechanics.
Right. Very interesting. So could you give us some examples of gamification that you've used in the past?
Yes, sure. I've used gamification to acquire new customers and prospects. For example, in France, with a game where pregnant ladies would go and win a status with a brand called Verbaudet. It was really interesting because the game was about gathering information, obviously, about the pregnant lady, but also making her play. And so you would have a pregnant lady on a chair, and then the game would be to see what's basically inside her belly, if I could say. So they would use the medical we had designed a medical environment. And the ladies would be able to play around and see around and see what their babies would be in terms of size, in terms of at what months, the lady would have to enter, I'm pregnant from what date. Then the system automatically would know what size normally the baby would be. Then the lady would be able to see her baby using a scan, a medical device that would show her what the baby would look like. So this one worked really well, because after that we could offer also or make some suggestions about clothes for the baby. The baby would come in the next 2 months, or maybe in 2 months it's going to be winter. So in the winter you should have this type of clothes for the baby to avoid the baby to be cold, this type of thing. So that was one of the example I mentioned to you about. The other example I used with the TVs when I was Sony, and we used that. There are many other examples.
So you can gamify anything.
Basically, you can have campaigns about increasing traffic and communicate on products, which I did regularly. You can also, for a brand called Mad Clothes, we did Be the Buyer. And again, so the clothes will be presented to you, and using augmented reality, you can see would look like in the clothes. I mean, there's so many examples that you could use that, as I said, I could talk for hours.
So what are the pros and cons of gamification?
So the pros is really focusing on engagement. That's to me the best way of engaging people. It's extremely important for any type of activity, as we mentioned. So it's extremely important. The cons, again, as we mentioned, you could have people obviously gaming the system. But I'm very concerned because I see a lot of people saying, oh, gamification is only about badges and points. And actually, extrinsic motivation, like the carrot and stick approach, is not sustainable. You have the badge fatigue. It's really will not work. So it's really important that these cons, you know, are avoided, and making sure that at least, you know, you focus more on the meaning of a campaign or meaning of a brand, the learning around the brand, what you can learn, what you need to, how you can grow with that, the self-knowledge, the fun, you know, the power, the mastery, the belonging, the autonomy. All these points are extremely important to make sure that at least a gamification campaign is transforming to a positive experience. So you have pros, you have cons, but I believe that if you do it well, then the pros are definitely bigger than the cons.
Yeah, it sounds like that from the return on investment. So could you find gamification in everyday online tools?
Yes, today more and more companies are investing in gamification. It's true, more Anglo-Saxon companies than the rest of the world. But for example, today I mentioned before, Salesforce.com is now using gamification, and you have a whole module based on that, and so it's part of the overall product. There is a company in the US called Badgeville, which was then bought by SAP not a long time ago. Wow. And SAP now, so Badgeville was basically a gamification platform company. So
Oh yes,
you've seen that. Okay. You have two big companies in the US, Badgeville and Bunchbowl. Badgeville now is SAP, and so when you think about SAP as a huge brand and a huge company with some big product, mm-hmm. using now gamification in pretty much all of their products as well. So it's becoming more and more, and it's true that because of now what you can see with the generation, I call them the Generation G, young kid, well, not young kid, but born around the year 2000. Mm-hmm. So Generation G for Google or gamification, that's what I like to say. But this first generation, they grew up with video games. They're getting to the positions now or entering the market, the work market. And, you know, they are replacing the baby boomers, at least my generation. And for the first time, you know, as they grow up with video games, they'll be making important decisions around society, policies, right. education, and so on. And it's not the kind of audience that we had in mind when we were talking about games, but this is the reality. These people now are going to use gamification because they were raised with game consoles. Some of them even were taught to read using a game console. So the game mechanic is essential to them. Right. And that's why gamification is going to be seen more and more with everyday tools. And that's why, you know, today SAP, Salesforce, all the big companies are getting involved in it.
Hmm, very interesting. Yeah, I've seen it. I use a Spanish app for learning Spanish, and yeah. and it's fantastic. They gamify that as well. And it really yeah. motivates you. I've had a break because I've been too busy with recording content, but it's amazing how it actually encourages you to do things.
Yes, that's absolutely. E-education, yeah. e-health, any type of activity today, yeah, we'll yeah. be able to use gamification, because gamification is not only about also mechanics. It's also about adding game, like game aesthetics around an application or something like that. So for example, for an older person or even somebody like me, you'll be more sensitive to something that comes and that's easier to use and that has great colors and things like that. That's part of the gamification as well.
Right. Fantastic. Well, that's really, really useful. So I think we're going to move on and talk about data and technology. So
it's
a big topic, right?
Yes.
And you know, I've got a few questions here that we've sort of prepared. So with data and technology, are we talking online or offline data?
So to me, we're talking about both online and offline, because today data is available everywhere you go. For example, you go from one place to another, you have GPS that tracks us, mobile phone that tracks you. We use a connected device, you leave a trace with Internet of Things. You buy online, you leave a trace. We answer an email, you leave a trace. But even if you move from one place to another and you don't use GPS or anything and your phone is off, but once you arrive at the new place, you're gonna be able to use offline data, and it's the combination of online and offline that's gonna make very, very powerful way of analyzing all the data.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ridiculous figure. The amount of data that's being produced every day is like something. It's just ridiculous, isn't it? Like we're drowning in this data. But that's like another. That's a whole conversation on its own.
But yes, absolutely.
It's massive, isn't it? But so what is open data?
So open data is what governments are putting, are developing these days regarding administrative data being available for everyone. So for example, if you want to know how many books are in your library, your public library in your town, or if you want to know how many red lights or how many traffic lights are involved, and or how many accidents are involved around traffic lights, or whatever information that is collected today by your government, according to European laws, at least, is needs to be available to anyone. So that's why open data is very important, because you now have access to online, offline, open, all this type of information that before nobody had a clue about. And so you can make, you know, any type of new application, any type of new disruptive tool using all this data.
Wow, that's quite interesting. Yeah, I mean, it's very interesting what they're doing over in New York in a city with data. I heard that actually the New York City government, if you want to open a retail outlet, they will actually help you to choose a retail outlet based upon the data source that they have on that particular outlet. So that store, for example, will have, you know, a certain number of people going past, but they will also know who those people are demographic wise. And if there's another coffee shop, for example, that say you're opening a coffee shop, if there's another coffee shop within a short distance, you know, that might not be the right outlet for your business. So that's quite interesting. I find it very interesting in how it can actually affect business. So what marketing techniques use data then, Nicholas?
So we're not going to go back to gamification, but obviously gamification use data. Marketing techniques that use data is really what we call predictive analytics. Today, you know, we've gone from an overall marketing, which is only for mass marketing, into a personalized marketing. When you have such a big amount of data, as you mentioned before, which is absolutely unbelievable, the marketing will be able to use the past, get some artificially intelligent programs around it, and being able to then calculate what's going to happen in the future, or could be tomorrow, it could be in a month, it could be in a year. And it's based on everything. And this is why I wanted to mention about open data, because open data can also obviously have an impact on that. But the marketing techniques that really important in this is really this predictive, which will allow companies to predict when customers will need their product, what type of product they will need, what kind of price they will need. We will be able to make a link, because open data is also about weather data. So whether that day was really rainy and we saw that based on the rain, And based on the fact that it was the fall season, then we were able to sell more of these trousers or more of these glasses or whatever. So this is where marketing is going to play a role, and a much bigger role than it is today, because today marketing, or today and up until the last 5 years, marketing was about guessing what the market would like, what people would like. Whereas here, we're going to be able to be much, much more precise about market needs and about product development. So at least you won't get any more issues around providing the right number of products, because that's also a big problem when you're a factory or when you or when you try to plan ahead of what you need to order. And so here, the marketing techniques that will basically be the most important for this, the use of data, to me is predictive.
Yeah. No, I agree 100%. All of that is so interesting for businesses and also for the entire supply chain. When you look at the food supply chain, I mean, I think that they're saying that the food supply chain will benefit from like a 15% reduction in costs, which is fascinating, because it means that they'll be able to provide, provide information on, you know, how much water the crop needs, which part of the field that needs vitamins and minerals through fertilizers, et cetera, and all of that adds up to the consumer benefiting. And also, you know, we will be able to perhaps not solve the homelessness problem and the hunger problem in the world, but we will be able to do a lot more to help the needy, you know, and that's really, really good.
Absolutely. We're going to be able to optimize the resources, and that's the key. That's the key with this new data approach. Absolutely.
Yeah. So we sort of talked around it, but how can data and technology go together then?
So technology is fed with data. So technology had to evolve in order for data to become so important. So for example, and we'll talk about that just after, I believe, or a little bit later on, but like big data and all these type of technology were invented because data became so important. And people started to realize, we've always known that data was important, but people started to realize that data had as a value, but it's much, much more than we ever thought. You know, data has value because we know how many customers we have. Well, that's great. It's really important to have that. But as you mentioned, you know, the optimization of resources, the making sure that at least we don't throw away anything anymore, that we don't, you know, that we, everything is done in a very professional and efficient way, it can only be done with the technology and data going together. So that's why it's important to mention that is today, because of all the disruption that we've seen with startups and with all the disruptive approaches that we've seen, we are capable of getting something that is so powerful. And on top of it, if you add the AI angle around it, artificial intelligence angle around it, then obviously you're going to get something much better.
That's what I'm mentioning. So with AI using data, how does that kind of work?
So basically, you will get data, which I would say is a fact. And what I mean by AI, I want to be very clear, because I know a lot of people are scared of artificial intelligence. I'm not talking about replacing human. I'm talking about human augmented.
Yeah,
it's not my sentence. It's something that that's out there and has been out there for a while. But it's basically being able to allow human to make better decisions based on a lot of data than alone we would not be able to base our decisions on. I'm talking about, like, for example, a doctor or a surgeon being able to look at all the possibilities, you know, with factual data, but also with an algorithm around it, which is artificially intelligent. And that algorithm will be able to show him all the different options. And then at the end, we always need the human to make a decision.
Yeah.
But at least the human will make a decision, a better decision, because he will have more information and will be able to process more information. And that's what I mean by, you know, AI using data is the more data we have, the better AI is going to be. And it's the same thing today when we see with Google, when you use Gmail or anything, the more you use it, the more precise it becomes. Now, I pretty much all my replies on Gmail, I only use the AI-powered algorithm that Google offers me. So it's becoming so clear, and it really matches what I like to do and how we and the words I like to use. So yeah. It's becoming really good, and I've been using Gmail for years and years, but I find it now extremely powerful, and it's helping me. You know, rather than writing an email that's going to take even 1 minute, it takes me 10 seconds, and then I can do a the rest 50 seconds, I can do something better, or I can spend it in a better way.
Yeah. I mean, it goes back to what they said about the Industrial Revolution. And actually, we are in the Industrial Revolution, and we're just starting to see the benefits, really, in terms of our working hours. I mean, you're in France and they have a 35-hour working week. I mean, wow, I'd love one of those.
To be honest with you,
you too.
It's because I used to work in the UK, so probably that's why. But I've never had 35 hours.
No, but they don't. They like lock you up or something if you work more than 30.
You're right.
I think that's brilliant. I think that's absolutely brilliant. But so really, it's about making sure that the data that you're collecting is very good quality, and. Yes. And knowing what you want that data for, and actually just, and also being careful with that data as well. I mean, security is another big topic we're not going to go into right now. But so what is predictive analytics then, Nicholas?
Yeah, so as I just mentioned, predictive analytics is the use of factual data that is collected through open data, through anything that basically you put in or that any company will collect. So talking about data coming from finance, from HR, from sales, from marketing, you know, all these companies used to have data that were just siloed. Mm-hmm. One area and not every type of departments will basically share their data. Mm-hmm. Here we're talking about getting all the data together. So that's factual data, historical data, that data that has gone through, and analyzing it around some very powerful algorithm to ensure that at least you predict what's going to happen in your business. So predictive analytics cannot happen for a startup that's just been around for 6 months, for example. I mean, they guess, I guess, but. In terms of big companies that have been around for a long time and want to transform their business, and that's why we talk about digital transformation, is using the data that's been available for years and years and years and making sure that at least behind it we put some value, which means like, okay, I want to analyze every January what kind of sales we've done. Do we have a plan that makes sense in the sense that is it pretty much every January, is it pretty much always the same amount, same type of products to be sold? What do the salespeople do in January? What do marketing people do in January? Do we have a lot of people who are sick in January? You know, all this type of information that every company has. I mean, even like what time do people come in the office in January because you badge. So you get all this type of information and then you think about what you want to see next January, the following January, and everything. And then you put in place, based on data, a strategy saying, okay, I see that every January my staff has the flu. Just something out of thinking about it. My staff has the flu every January and I have a very high percentage of people not being around. Well, then guess what? Next January, I'm going to put in place a flu vaccination program.
Right.
You see, so this type of information, I mean, obviously, this is very simple what I just said, and it could go much, much further down in terms of analysis. But here's to make sure that everybody understands that now that every single department will be sharing that data, then the CEO, the head of HR, whoever would be able to make a decision based on data that has been used and that is, you know, looking forward to what you want.
Yeah, and you can also plug in social media data, weather data, everything else, which is going to help you to actually understand what, you know, to predict what you need to buy, your resources you need to allocate to whichever department actually needs the information. And yeah, I think it's fantastically interesting.
Well, I also have another example actually of a customer that I've helped doing a digital transformation. Mm-hmm. In HR, we were able to analyze the data coming from social networks, like for example, mainly LinkedIn. Mm-hmm. And looking at that, we were able to tell when people would come in. So number one, you can say before the interview what people have done in the past and what people have said about them, which company they worked for, everything to make sure at least their CVs are in order. But one person, one HR director that I worked with, was telling me, said it's so powerful is that now we know before even the person knows when they're going to get bored in their job.
Wow.
Because we've analyzed all their data onto LinkedIn and realized that, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, it's not the exact the truth here, but I'm just giving an example. So they say, for example, in 3 years' time, we know that this person is going to get bored. So we're going to put a career path in for him or her, saying that, you know, in the next 2 years, we're going to train them to do something else. Mm. So before even the person is bored, because you can see trends like this, you can see people, you know, they leave jobs after 2 years, after 3 years, and normally it repeats itself. So with this predictive analytics, you plan ahead and you make sure at least, or even if you don't want this person to change jobs after 3 years, but you start talking to them and say, you know, is there anything you would like us to change, you know, or can we add some more responsibilities to you? I mean, whatever, in order to make sure that at least that the person will stay and will not leave the company after 3 years.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And just tweak what's going on to suit them so you retain
exactly
for longer. Yeah.
That's predictive analytics.
Yeah. So what is big data and how can anyone use it?
So big data is a big database, basically. It's a little bit technology. It's a non-structured data, what we call normally NoSQL for not only SQL. I mean, because databases, normal databases, if I could call them normal, are SQL-based, which is sequences. Mm-hmm. And here there are no SQL databases, which means that you can enter the information and the amount, the huge amount of data. I mean, and there's no limit to it. Well, technology is a limit, but I think it's getting really with no limit. So you're getting a lot of data into the NoSQL database, and then you structure it in order to get the analysis that you want. So predictive analysis, AI analysis, any type of analysis, you get it out in a form with clusters in general. And so you start doing all the big analysis like this. That's why it's called big data. It's because the amount of data is enormous compared to what we used to be able to do.
So that big data can come from any, how do I put this? Any activity. So it could be from an Internet of Things sensor that pings your router that then gathers data, or it could be from your iWatch that has run an ECG. iWatch yep. 4 does ECG. So then your iPhone knows that, you know, your heart rate is too high, and if you don't calm down, then you're going to have like a problem. So it tells you to calm down, right? So.
Yep.
Basically, it can be from anywhere, and it could be, you know, the websites that you're visiting. It could be how much time you spend on your phone. It can go even beyond that, though, can't it? It can go to, you know, you being tracked as an individual in marketing. So you go to a certain shopping center and they know that you're actually in the aisle looking at a pair of shoes that you looked at online, and then they can send you a voucher, right, for example, yeah?
Potentially yes, but today you have a very strong European laws about data protection.
you do, but it just depends. It depends on the company, right, and their policies and
yeah, absolutely
what you've signed up for. I mean, I block a lot of stuff collecting data on me because I don't want, and I erase it every day. I make sure I'm very careful with that because I don't want loads of personalized adverts trying to persuade me to buy stuff. But other people enjoy that. Other people actually want that because it makes their life easier, because they don't have to remember that they looked at a website and they want to buy something because they got interrupted. So it all depends on the individual, right? And
absolutely,
and what you want.
That's the beauty today with technology and data, is you can do what feels right to you. Again, we are very protected in Europe. I mean, if you go to China or whatever, you're not protected at all. They have 100 millions cameras around,
yeah,
filming all the time in China, you know, and you can't say anything. You can't even have access to your data or anything. Mm. Us in Europe, we do have access to our data, and we can say no if we don't want. As you mentioned, every night before I go to bed, I actually go to Google My Activity and I delete all my activity.
Yeah.
Because I don't want other people to use it. Yeah. If you're fine with it, then obviously the technology is there today that definitely somebody can check where you are and what you do, and they can offer you what you probably don't even know yourself going to that shop you're going to want.
Exactly. But then it's kind of like, well, it can kind of mess up with your brain. It's like, look, you know, we actually need to be using our brains here. So let's kind of just keep, you know, perhaps an eye on our phone, but let's not let it control our lives. Let's actually take the time to think ourselves instead of, you know, letting technology run our lives. And that's another story as well, isn't it, really? But
absolutely.
We've kind of talked quite a lot about how anyone can use big data, right? But there are many, there are many, many ways to use it. I suppose it starts off with what outcome do you want? And then you decide what data you need to collect in order to make the outcome happen more seamlessly. I mean, that's a pretty simple way of explaining it, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
absolutely. Simple way for a company to put it in place. For any individual like you and I, you know, there's no point, because you really need to get a lot of data.
Yeah.
But for a company to use it, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. So what activities use big data then?
Today it's pretty much everything. I mean, e-commerce uses big data big time, if I could say. Digital marketing, politics, they use big data. The press use big data.
Yeah.
Insurance, banks. The press is using big data, and it's pretty recent. What they do is also to ensure that they don't have fake news.
Right.
Because with the big data, you can cross a lot of information coming from a lot of places. And for example, if you see that the source comes always from the same place geographically, then you know to be very careful about the information. So the press is actually pretty recent. But insurance and banks use big data. Let's say that you have a car accident and, you know, the insurance can see that you were at the pub just before. It's very likely that you've been drinking or things like that. So that they could also get the data like this. Obviously, I'm just saying that it's potentially possible. But again, with the data protection rights, it will not happen today. Education uses also big data, human resources, medical. I mean, pretty much every single activity that you see on the, and it's really, I don't want people to feel that they're scared of when they hear big data, when they hear about artificial intelligence. It's really to improve, and again to optimize resources by getting various sources around of data, and that's why it's important. It's true that if it's misused, and I think I'm going over probably to the questions after. But if it's misused, it could be potentially very dangerous. But with the laws that we have in place and the way we're handling it, I think we see more pros than cons, to be honest with you.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we as consumers want things to be cheap. We want things to be easy. And that's the only way for us to actually get what we want. So, you know, we could talk about this for hours. And I think we should at some stage talk about it more. But for now, I think that's absolutely fantastic. I really appreciate all your time. And if people want to get hold of you, how would they find you, Nicholas?
They can find me on Twitter, NicoChan33, or they can find me on LinkedIn. Oh, and there's also an article on Wikipedia.
Okay, great. Well, I'll drop a link in there so everyone can contact you. And thank you so much.
That'd be great.
That's been
you're very welcome.
Thanks very much for listening to Influential Visions. Please make sure you share this episode with your friends and business connections.